Well, thanks again for the invitation and the opportunity to at least share a little bit about what's going on in the Western Lake Erie Basin and some of the edge of field work. And I am going to try to mix a little bit of the 4R or the soil health aspects of this session into the 4Rs. But primarily, this is a research project that we began back about 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, to investigate the impacts of the 4R nutrient stewardship concept and the certification program within the Western Lake Erie Basin. So this is our research team. So I think Tom is in the room. I don't know if we have anybody else here or not, but we've got folks from Heidelberg University, folks from the Nature Conservancy and Ohio State University, as well as a consultant group, Limnotech, out of Michigan. So I think we heard earlier somebody brought up the three P's, and that's really what the goal here is to investigate the three P's, that planet, profit, and people, what we also call the triple bottom line, if you will, of the adoption of the 4Rs and the 4R Nutrient Stewardship Program. This project, it's a five-year project. We had four primary objectives. They include the monitoring or data collection, the field aspects of the 4R impacts, and they include both edge of field, which we talked a little bit about earlier and one of the students talked about this morning, as well as the watershed scale, and that's where we work with Heidelberg University. They've got a pretty good tributary monitoring program, and so we've rely on them to provide that watershed scale assessments. And then we have a modeling component. Obviously, we can't go out and measure every single data point, so we have to rely on the models to tell us, based on what we're measuring, should we expect to see an impact or not? And so we've got both the field scale and the watershed scale modeling going on as part of this project. And then one of the unique aspects is the behavioral, what we'll call the socioeconomic part of this. And so what we've gone out and worked with some social scientists, some economists, to try to understand what the impacts are, what goes into a decision for a producer. How well are they informed, and how do they make those decisions? And we're trying to figure out this more holistic approach at how do we sell these practices then and get more adoption, widespread adoption. And then we have a big outreach and education component that we try to take all of what we've learned and go out and sell that to the farmers. And with Ohio, it's unique. I'll get into this in the end, but there's some legislation that has been passed that requires farmers, anybody that's putting nutrients on, that manages more than 50 acres, has to be certified in the state. So this is a real opportunity for us to educate them with the data that we have collected and the findings that we have. So the first slide that I showed, the title slide sort of showed the an edge of field site. You saw one earlier if you were here from Kansas. These are the locations we have. Like in Vermont, I think we are working on private farms. These are all producers that we've gone out and worked with. We have roughly 21 paired fields where we are collecting data within the state, and these fields range in size from anywhere from 5 acres up to about 45 acres, and they are in a paired fashion. So that sort of idea of the split things that Steve was talking about, the split comparison, we're looking at side by side. Although we're having to come at it a little bit more from the scientific standpoint because we do have to publish it. We're using a before-after control impact design, meaning that we're collecting baseline data for a period, and then we're going to implement some type of change in order to quantify the impact of a specific practice. The other unique part, in Vermont you're starting to have some tile drainage, but we have very poorly drained soils in Ohio and in the Western Lake Erie Basin. These are very heavy clays, so most of these are underlain with artificial tile drainage. So we are collecting both the surface and the subsurface points at these locations. So when we talk about these 20 paired sites, you can think about that as 80 sampling points is where we're going out and collecting that data from these sites. So I'm going to dive into the data a little bit to give you a flavor of what we're seeing. And again, this is pretty much in the baseline period. We are just now starting to implement treatments. We've been working. We've gone out and we've met with all the 20 producers over the last 2 to 3 months, right before harvest. And now we've implemented, or they will implement, some type of change, mostly due to with implementing some 4R practices. There are cover crop practices as well. There's drainage, there's water control type practices. So we're looking at a suite of different practices that we're going to try to implement. The other thing that we're doing, which I just talked to Wayne Honeycutt, by the way, Steve, on all of these sites, is we're doing a soil health assessment of these. So we're going out and we're collecting cores down to about a meter deep, down to the tile drain depth, multiple cores, generally about 6 to 12 or 15 in each individual field. And we'll be doing those soil health assessments. So we'll be looking at those physical, chemical, and biological properties. So that's really a spinoff of this project that's come about. The primary point of this project was to look at the water quality associated with Lake Erie, and can we have an impact on that? So we're really looking at the phosphorus aspect. So it's really what I want to get into here. And I realized the x-axis didn't show up. So the two bar graphs, or the whisker box and whiskers plots on the left, are dissolved phosphorus concentrations. The ones on the right are total phosphorus concentrations. And these are event mean concentrations from all of the data. So this is roughly 4,500 rainfall events that we've collected across all of our sites so far. And so what you can see is the amount of dissolved phosphorus, or the event mean concentration of both the dissolved and the total, is greater coming from the surface than what we see coming out of the subsurface tile drainage. That red dashed line is the threshold. There's a binational agreement with Canada and the United States, Ohio, Indiana, and Michigan specifically, that border Lake Erie, and that is the target range. So that's where we're trying to be. So if we look at that, the concentrations coming from that tile drainage are very close, at least the median concentrations are close to where we would want to be. What we see is the surface is about three times greater than that. So, you know, the question becomes, in what practices might we implement to where we can we reduce that concentration? But concentration is only one aspect. It's only one part of the story. And I know this is a busy graph, so don't get embedded in looking at all the detail. But what I want you to look at is the black parts of the graph and the white parts in those bars. And the black parts are the loading. That's the mass that we're losing. And that's coming from the tile drainage. So by and large, because we have such flat topography and because these are so intensively tile drained, most of the water that leaves these sites are coming through the tile drainage, so the subsurface losses. So again, the red line is equivalent to that threshold mass loss that we're trying. If you divide that across the whole area, that's sort of the target that we're looking at. And that's for UCCAs, it's important to look. I mean, and I know you're in different regions, but for here, that works out to be about a quarter of a pound an acre. That's what we're working with. I mean, I'm not sure we can ask farmers to go any lower. I mean, it's very, very difficult. But that's the margin that we're working with. It's that same quarter of a pound that's causing Lake Erie to turn green. So, again, that's the amount they're working with. When I look at this, and again, we have to look at this. This is an average basis, and there's some other metrics that the binational agreement uses. They use a spring loading. They'll use the annual loading. When we look at this, if you look at that, we've got a lot of producers that already are at that threshold, and to me, that's encouraging. It says agriculture is doing a pretty good job. Can we improve? Absolutely, we can improve. I mean, but we got to understand these are leaky systems. They're not zero discharge systems, so we're always going to have some leakage. But when I look at this, and I can say that, you know, 30% of our producers right now are at that quarter of a pound per acre loss, and we've got another 40%, 50% of those that are within range. What we think that with the 4Rs, with some other treatments, that we can get them there, then that to me is quite exciting. So then we get into the complicating factors, weather, and it does play a major role. when we look at, again, these are those 4,500 rainfall events. And when we look at this, we can look at the top 20% of those rainfall events, which equivalent, that's the 1.5 inches and greater of rainfall. They account for about 40% of all the surface discharge and about 60 to 65% of all the 40% of the subsurface and about 60% of all the surface discharge and loading that we see coming from these sites. So, you know, we want to start thinking about how do we store more water in the landscape. And I think Steve, he put that graph up twice about the Hudson. There's a Hudson reference, and that's the organic matter and how much available water holding capacity that we can have. And I think that's important for us to note that with if we can get that organic matter up, for every percent organic matter that we have in our soil, it's about 3/4 of an inch of water storage capacity. So when we look at the soils that were formed, at least in Ohio and the Great Black Swamp, most of those soils before the settlers came in and settled those were about 5.5 to 6%, maybe 6.5% organic matter. When we look at the surveys now, when we get the soil tests back, those soil tests show anywhere from 1.5 to about 3.5% generally. So we've got an opportunity to get 2 to 3 more percent organic matter, and we can store this 1.5 to 2 inches of water. And that's not going to go downstream. It's not going to carry those nutrients with it. So what I want to do now is just focus on the data a little bit, at least the edge of field part of it, on the aspects of the 4Rs specifically. So when we look at P losses and the fertilizer source, if we look at that top graph, that's just the average from all the sites. So you got to understand, when we first went into these locations, we had no idea what the soil test levels were. So these soil test levels ranged anywhere from our smallest is 12 parts per million malic 3, and this is in the top 6 to 8 inches. And then we got a field that all the way through that plow layer, through that top 6 to 8 inches, is 400 parts per million. So when we look at these, we've got, as I said, most of the range is in that sort of the agronomic range, high end of agronomic, but we have sites in the 120, 130, again, over 300 and even up to 400 parts per million. So when we look at this, when we look at that top graph and we look and see what the losses, first look says it has to do with the organic nutrient source. But if we had a producer, again, we've started doing some treatments. This is after 1 year of data. We put equal rates of MAP and equal rates of dairy manure on the bottom. And lo and behold, what do we see? We see no difference in the losses. So if we manage those nutrients according to the right rate, we should not expect to see a difference whether we're using a manure or whether we're using a commercial fertilizer source. We'll look at P losses and application rates. The top left graph is our producers that we're working with. That line is sort of the tri-state recommendation. That's sort of what we expect to see from a 200, and if we have a goal of I think it's 220 bushel per acre corn yield target, that's the application rate that we should be applying. You can sort of see where our farmers are, those that are using both an inorganic source, which are the closed circles, or an organic source, which are the open symbols. So for the most part, our producers are inside that or under that envelope, if you will, but we have several that are outside. And so those are producers that we're trying to work with to get them educated and also look to see, are they seeing more losses on those sites or not? The bottom graph is some of this data, but it's mostly data from across the U.S. It's Laura was in the room. I don't know if she's still here or not. Laura Christensen's some of her work that basically shows that the higher the application rate, the more loss that we have. And that's, again, from several studies across the U.S. Looking specifically at the data from our 40 fields, our 20 paired sites, if we think about the loss and time of application, we can look at this in two ways. We can look at time since application, which are the top four graphs. And again, don't get embedded in those. But basically, you see the cooler the hotter, the warmer colors are generally when we have more potential for loss. What's interesting is this idea of the time of the year, though. We have a lot of looking at spring versus fall applications. And generally what we see is the least potential for loss is when we're applying it at planting or even after wheat harvest, a small grain. And wheat is a hard sell, at least in Ohio. It's the economics are just not there. So it's really hard to get producers to put a small grain into their rotation. But if we can, it also opens up a window of opportunity to apply those nutrients. And then we want to look at placement, and this one's getting a lot of attention. Generally, we think of subsurface placement as providing, that's where we want to get the nutrients. Again, keep in mind, this is data averaged across all of our fields. So we're not seeing a statistically significant benefit to subsurface placement per se. Again, but that keep in mind that that's the average, and it's something we need to guard against is maybe just looking at averages. Because what we're doing, again, we've got a lot of different soil test phosphorus levels. We've got a lot of other managements. And as someone said earlier, every field is different. Every producer is different. There's not any one of the two producers that we work with that manage the same. They don't even have the same equipment available. So I think we have to look at these from a systematic approach and a holistic approach that they are all different. But having said that, if we look at just an individual field and a study that we did, looking at fertilizer placement, we do see a significant decrease in the amount of phosphorus that is lost in the subsurface flow through both injection and tilling that in, that subsurface placement, if you will, compared to just a broadcast application. So again, we have to look at these individually and understand that there are other factors that go into this into making that nutrient move below the surface and into the tile drainage. So this is a direction that we're going now is really looking at these phosphorus budgets per field, and these are the fields that we're looking at right now. So we have how much is being applied, that's the top part, the green part, and then how much is coming off in the harvest, which is sort of the brownish, so the negative part. And then that margin that we're working with, those gray and red areas on the bottom of those bar graphs, that's what we're trying to further reduce. I mean, that's our opportunity to further reduce that. So that's what's going out in the water. And it's a very difficult challenge, as I said, because if we think about what a normal farmer applying anywhere from 20 to 30 pounds an acre probably, we're losing, you know, we're talking a quarter to a half a pound an acre. It's a very, very small amount. From a, you show me any other business that is that efficient, and there's not many. So this is where we're trying to look now is some of these budgets to try to understand, what other practices we have at our disposal. So that's really the edge of field component that I wanted to talk about. Now I want to highlight some of the other aspects of the project as a whole. This is the watershed scale aspect. So as I said, Heidelberg University is leading this component of the project. They have tributary monitoring where they're looking at the 10 primary tributaries going into Lake Erie. And so they've been collecting data. And this is how we know that we have an issue, that we know the dissolved fraction of phosphorus is going up. They started collecting data back in the 1970s, and so that's the data that we're and they've continued that on. So we can see that uptake or that uptrend, if you will, in the dissolved fraction of phosphorus. So here's the unit area loads from those 10 tributaries that you can see. We can look at both. We can look at total phosphorus. We can look at dissolved reactive, and we can look at the nitrogen. So you can sort of see where they are, and this was 2016, but you can also look at that five-year average, and so you can see where we rate each year. We're also looking at factors that influence that. So one of the things that we've gotten into now is because of the 4R certification program, we're starting to look at how many retailers and how many acres are affected by those retailers. And so the graph on the left is the number of certified retailers per square mile. That are in each one of those watersheds. But we also have to look at there's hydrology involved as well, the flashiness of those, how much agriculture is involved in some of those watersheds. So there are other factors that are going into this. So this is the direction. It's more of a progress, an update of where we are, but these are the directions where we're going in terms of looking at the impact of this 4R certification program. as I said earlier, we have a modeling. We do have a modeling component that carries that's looking at the edge of the field from through the watershed and then to the lake itself. We're using a linked models approach. This is using a watershed simulation model SWOT, but we also have a Lake Erie model. So we can take the outputs from those models, and then we can put them into the lake model, and then that lake model we can determine what the extent or the growth of that algae bloom is expected to be. And so by implementing different practices, there's sort of the tributary flow of the modeling. Like I said, we're looking at flow, sediment, and nutrients. So looking at some of these different scenarios, if you will, looking at that broadcast versus incorporation, looking at incorporating within a certain time, the spring versus the fall, some of those type things, looking at maybe we reduce it, maybe if we can get the rotation up or enhance the rotation where we're only applying nutrients every third year, some of those type things, we can use the models then to sort of predict what's going to happen, not just at the mouth of going into the lake, but then the lake itself, because we do have the lake model. So again, it provides us an opportunity to project what those impacts might be prior to trying to get a widespread adoption. The last thing we want to do is recommend a practice, get it implemented, and it does not have it a change at all. And the agriculture community is going to have the finger pointed right back at them to see you didn't do enough. So we want to look at all the options that we have available to try to test these different practices. And lastly, I've got one more section, but the socioeconomic component. And again, this is a linking that behavioral and the physical models. And this is work with Ohio State University, specifically Dr. Robin Wilson. And so what Robin has done is gone out and she's done a survey of the producers in the watershed. She stratified this, so we really wanted to look at producers over 50 acres. That's the numbers we wanted to look at. The response rate was pretty good. We had a 30% response rate in looking at those. So the questions that Robin was asking is what do farmers think about nutrient losses and water quality? What factors are driving the adoption? What's the likelihood of voluntary adoption? And to what extent can these factors be leveraged? So let's look at these just a little bit. So here's the current farmer's beliefs based on this survey, and this was a 2016 survey. 77% think they have a good understanding of the 4 R's. And you have to understand in that basin, in the Western Lake Erie Basin, the 4 R's really in about 2000 and around 13, 14, it's really, there was a lot of literature put out. There was a document that was put out that was signed on by 20 plus agencies and farm co-ops and entities in the state that really promoted the 4 R's. 82% agree that they think that about nutrient stewardship as it relates to water quality. 56% have changed their 4 R related practices in the past 3 years. 54% are concerned about their farms contributing to the harmful algal blooms in Lake Erie. So let's look at that. Again, Robin's done a lot of work over the years. So these are surveys that were done in the basin, and we can start to see this, some trends, if you will. Nutrient loss concern has gone up. Maybe, again, those awareness came out in 13. Remember, 14 is when we had a do not drink warning for the city of Toledo. So it's not much change since that time. Nutrient loss concern at Lake Erie has gone up. If you just look at the general trends of here, most all of these are on the rise. And then if we look at specifically to some of the practices, this idea of cover crops. Cover crops are hard. I mean, again, it's the economics of those. I think someone said earlier, it's not something you can totally jump into, and I would totally agree with that. We've got producers that are still trying to learn from that, but there is some more adoption of that. It is slow though. Delaying broadcasting in light of storm events. We've got legislation in Ohio now where you have to be able to document. You cannot apply if there's a half inch of rain expected within 24 hours. And as a farmer, you have to be able to show that you are in compliance. There are different apps now that they have on their phones to look at that, look at the weather forecast and document that. Avoiding winter and frozen surface application, again, that's something that, again, the legislation in Ohio has taken into account. It's banned. We cannot apply on frozen snow-covered ground. Subsurface placement, again, we're trying to get more adoption of subsurface placement. Again, it's economics. I mean, we're talking about $150,000 to $200,000 piece of equipment in order to do that subsurface placement. So it's hard for a producer to justify doing that. Some of the co-ops are buying those pieces of equipment, those toolbars. They're going out and utilizing those, but again, we're talking 4 to 6, 7, 8% of their acres. It takes a lot more time to do that than it does with a spinner. I mean, we can go out and cover a whole lot more acres that way than we can subsurface placement. So it's the trade-offs, it's the balance. So how do we get more adoption of those? So that's one of the things that we're looking at. So this is where we think we need to be based on Robin's survey, sort of the average of those 2013 and 16 publication or surveys. And then there was a publication in 2017 that came out and said, this is based on the models, this is where we need to be for these different practices. And this is making sure we're putting rates on based on soil tests, avoiding those winter application, avoiding the near storm application, subsurface placement, cover crops, and then water, drainage management. And that's a big one in Ohio. Because we have the subsurface placement, we do have an opportunity to manage the drainage water. If we can control the water, we can go a long way in controlling a lot of the problems. So just thinking about some of the recap on these, what do farmers think? They are concerned, they're aware, they're knowledgeable. The likelihood of voluntary adoption is pretty high, 30 to 40%. What factors are driving the adoption? The self-efficacy, confidence in their abilities. To what extent can these factors be leveraged? It really depends. But I do believe, and I think it was said earlier, I didn't hear it specifically, but it's going to be solved. These issues are going to be solved in the coffee shop. It's going to be, if we can get our the primary producers involved and get them to adopt it, then it's going to solve itself in the coffee shop. And finally, I'll just talk real briefly. I got a couple slides on the outreach, and this is on the website down at the bottom right. You can see it's updated periodically, but we do have 37 for our certified nutrient service providers now in the Western Lake Erie Basin. That's covering about 1.9 million acres, so about 38% of the watershed. Some metrics there on the project itself right now. We are trying to reach out. We go to a lot of presentations with farmers and a lot of field days to get this message across. Again, I talked about that earlier. I talked about the fertilizer certification. Within Ohio, we've got 17,500 roughly farmers that we're trying to get to. Today, they are certified. There are 17,493 of them are certified, and that's throughout the state. Where you can see that, and then from those results, there's some surveys within those results, and these are some of the questions that they strongly agree with. Farm P is a significant problem. They've improved their knowledge, and that they will change their nutrient management practices. So, with that, I think I used up my time. Probably, Nick. Sorry, but. Thank you for the opportunity to share. And said I'll be around for a little bit if you have specific questions. So.